The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story by Olga Tokarczuk. Olga Tokarczuk is a Polish writer. She was awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Literature for a narrative imagination that, with encyclopedic passion, represents the crossing of boundaries as a form of life. So, from the fiction section of the September 20, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Yente, by Olga Tokarczuk. Asher Rubin goes in through the dark, muddy courtyard of Alicia's house, where just slaughtered geese, fattened all summer long, hang upside down. He walks through a narrow entryway and smells the fried cutlets and onions, hears someone somewhere grinding pepper in a mortar. The women are noisy in the kitchen. The cold air is pierced by the steam that comes from there, from the dishes they're preparing. There are the smells of vinegar, nutmeg, bay leaves. There is the aroma of fresh meat, sweet and sickening. These scents make the autumn air seem even colder and more unpleasant. The men behind the wooden partition speak aggressively, as if they were arguing. He can hear their voices and also smell candle wax and the damp that has permeated their clothing. The house is full to bursting. Asher passes children. The little ones pay him no attention, too excited about the impending festivities. He passes through a second courtyard, which is weakly lit by a single torch. At the doorstep, he runs into a tipsy Yehuda, whom the whole family calls Leb. As a matter of fact, Reuben's name isn't Reuben either, but Asher Ben Levi. Now, in the semi-darkness and the throng of guests, all names seem somehow fluid, interchangeable, secondary. After all, no mortal holds onto his name for very long. Without a word, Yehuda leads him deep into the house and opens the door to a small room where some young women are working, and in a bed by the stove lies an old woman, supported by pillows, her face dried out and pale. The women greet him effusively and position themselves around the bed, curious to watch. Yente is small and thin, like an old chicken, and her body is limp. Her chicken's rib cage rises and falls at a rapid rate. Her half-open mouth, framed by extremely thin lips, caves inward. But her dark eyes follow the medic's movements. After he has chased all the onlookers from the room, he lifts the covers and sees her whole body, the size of a child's, sees her bony hands clutching strings and leather strips. They have wrapped her up to her neck in wolf hides. They believe that wolf hides restore heat and strength. How could they have brought along this old woman with so little life left in her, Asher thinks. She looks like a shriveled old mushroom, her brown face cruelly carved up by the candlelight, making her appear no longer human. Asher has the sense that soon she will be indistinguishable from nature, from tree bark, gnarled wood, a rough stone. Not that there is anything surprising in her wanting to attend her relative's wedding, since there will be cousins from Moravia and from distant Lublin here as well. Asher crouches beside the low bed and immediately smells the saltiness of human sweat, and he thinks for a moment, trying to place the scent. Childhood. At Yente's age, people start to smell like children again. He knows that there is nothing wrong with this woman. She's simply dying. He examines her carefully and finds nothing other than old age. Her heart is beating unevenly and weakly, as if exhausted. Her skin is clear, but thin and dry like parchment. Her eyes are glassy, sunken. Her temples are sinking too, a sure sign of impending death. At her throat, under her slightly unbuttoned shirt, he can see some strings and knots. He touches one of the old woman's clenched fists, and for a moment she resists. But then, as if she were ashamed, her fist blossoms open like a desert rose. In her palm lies a piece of silk cloth completely covered in thick letters. It almost seems that Yinti is smiling at him with her toothless mouth, and her deep, dark eyes reflect the candles burning. Asher feels as if that reflection were reaching him from very far away, from the unfathomable depths that all human beings hold within them. "What's wrong with her? What's wrong with her?" Alicia asks him, suddenly bursting into that cramped space. Asher rises slowly and looks into his anxious face. "What do you think? She's dying. She won't last the wedding." Asher Rubin makes a face that speaks for itself. Why did they bring her here in such a state? Alicia grabs him by the elbow and takes him aside. "You have methods. You have your methods, don't you? That we don't know? Help us, please, Asher. The meat has already been chopped, the carrots peeled, the raisins are soaking in the bowls, the women are cleaning the carp. Did you see how many guests there are?" "Her heart is barely beating," Reuben says. "There's nothing I can do. She should never have been brought on such a journey." He delicately frees his elbow from the grasp of Alicia Shore and heads for the door. Since Yinti is the eldest person present, everyone who comes for the wedding immediately goes to pay her a visit. Guests stream into her little room at the end of the labyrinth in the second house, which you must pass through another courtyard to reach, and which is just across the street from the cemetery. Children peer in through the cracks in the walls, high time to seal them before winter sets in. Alicia's daughter, Haya, sits with her a long while. Yinti puts Haya's hands on her face, touches her eyes, her lips, and her cheeks. The children see this. She pats her head. Haya brings her treats, gives her chicken broth to drink, adding a spoonful of goose fat, and old Yinti smacks her thin, dry lips for a long time when she's finished, although even the fat doesn't give her enough strength to get up. As soon as they arrive, the Moravians Solomon Zalman and his extremely young wife, Schneidel, go to visit their old cousin. It took them 3 weeks to get here from Vuhn, though through Zlin and Preschau, and then Drobohospitz, but they will not go back the same way. In the mountains, some escaped serfs attacked them, and Zalman had to pay a considerable ransom. They were lucky the serfs didn't take everything they had. They'll go back through Krakow before snow falls. Schneidel is already pregnant with her first child. She's just informed her husband of it. She is often nauseated. This is not at all helped by the smell of coffee and spices that greets you when you enter the vast chore household or when you go into the shop. She also doesn't like how old Yinti smells. She fears this woman, with her bizarre clothing and hair on her chin, as she would a wild animal. In Moravia, old women look a lot tidier. They wear starched bonnets and neat aprons. Schneidel is convinced that Yinti is a witch. She's afraid to sit down on the bed, although everyone keeps telling her to do so. She's afraid the old woman will pass something on to the child in her belly, some dark, indomitable madness. She tries not to touch anything in that little room. The smell never stops making her sick. Her Bodolian relatives all seem wild to her. Finally, however, they push Schneidel toward the old woman, and she perches on the very edge of the bed, ready to flee at any moment. She does, however, like the smell of wax. She secretly sniffs every candle, and of mud mixed with horse droppings, and now she knows of vodka. Solomon, significantly older than she is, with a solid build and a belly, a middle-aged man with a beard, proud of his lovely wife, brings her a shot of vodka every once in a while. Schneidel tastes the drink but cannot swallow it. She spits it out on the floor. When the young wife sits down, Yinti's hand shoots out from under the wolfskins and lands on Schneidel's belly. Schnadel isn't showing it. But Yinti can see that a separate soul has taken up residence in her belly. A soul that is still indistinct, hard to describe because it is multiple. These free souls are everywhere, just waiting for the opportunity to grab some unclaimed bit of matter. And now they lick this little lump, which looks a bit like a tadpole inspecting it, though there is still nothing concrete in it, just shreds, shadows. They probe it, testing. The souls consist of streaks, of images and recollections, memories of acts, fragments of sentences, letters. Never before has Yinti seen this so clearly. Truth be told, Schnadel gets uncomfortable sometimes, for she, too, can feel their presence. As if dozens of strangers' hands were pressing on her, as if she were being touched by hundreds of fingers. She doesn't want to confide in her husband about this, and anyway, she wouldn't be able to find the words. While the men sit in one chamber, the women gather in Yinti's room, where they scarcely all fit. Every now and then, one of them brings some vodka from the kitchen, wedding vodka, in semi-secret, like a smuggler, but of course this too is part of the fun. Crowded together and excited about the impending festivities, they forget themselves and start to clown around. But this doesn't seem to bother the ailing Yinti. She may even be pleased that she's become the center of the merriment. Sometimes they glance at her, uneasy, feeling a bit guilty as she suddenly dozes off, then a moment later awakens with a childlike smile. Schnadel gives Haya a significant look as Haya straightens the wolfskins on the old woman, wraps her own scarf around Yinti's neck, and sees all the amulets she wears there, little pouches on strings, little pieces of wood with symbols written out on them, figures made of bone. Haya doesn't dare to touch them. The women tell terrible stories about ghosts, lost souls, people buried alive, ill omens. If you only knew how many evil spirits were lurking in a single droplet of your beloved blood, you would all at once turn over your bodies and your souls to the creator of this world. Zippa, a woman who is considered learned, the wife of old Natka, says. Well, where are the spirits? One of the women asks in a tremulous whisper, and Zippa picks up a stick from the dirt floor and points at its tip. Here! They are all! Take a good look! The woman stare at the tip of the stick, their eyes squinting in a funny way. One of them starts to giggle, and in the light of just a few candles now they see double or triple, but they don't see any spirits. In the night, when everyone has gone to sleep, Alicia Shore, writing by candlelight, scratches out the following letters on a tiny piece of paper. Hey, Mem, Tav, Nun, Hey, Hamtana, waiting. Haya stands in a white nightgown, tracing an invisible circle around herself in the air. Now she lifts the scrap of paper over her head. She stands this way for a long while. Her mouth is moving. She blows on the paper a few times, and then she rolls it up very carefully and slips it inside a wooden vessel the size of a thumbnail. She stays there for a long time in silence, her head bowed, till suddenly she licks her fingers and sticks a strap through the hole in the amulet, which she hands to her father. Alicia, candle in hand, glides through the sleeping, rustling, intermittently snoring household, through the narrow hallways to the room where Yinti lies. He pauses at the door and listens. Evidently untroubled by anything he hears there, he softly opens the door, which humbly submits to him without a sound, revealing cramped quarters faintly lit by an oil lamp. Yinti's sharp nose is pointed straight up at the ceiling, casting a defiant shadow on the wall. Alicia has to pass through it in order to lay the amulet on the dying woman's neck. When he leans over her, her eyelids flutter, and Alicia freezes mid-motion. but it's nothing. She's clearly just having a dream. Her breathing is so light as to be almost imperceptible. Alicia ties the end to the strap and slides the amulet under the old woman's nightgown. Then he turns on his toes and vanishes as quietly as he came. When the candlelight gets faint in the cracks of the wood, Yinti opens her eyes and, with a weakening hand, feels for the amulet. She knows what's written on it. She breaks the strap, opens the vessel, and swallows the scrap of paper like a pill. The servants keep coming into Yinti's small, cramped room with the guest coats and laying them at the foot of the bed. By the time the music starts, you can barely see Yinti beneath the pile of garments. Only when Haya drops by is order restored. The coats move to the floor. Haya bends down over her elderly aunt and listens for her breathing, which is so weak it seems a butterfly would stir up more of a breeze. But her heart is beating. Haya, slightly flushed from the vodka, presses her ear into Yinti's breast, to the cluster of amulets, strings, and straps, and she hears a delicate boom, boom, very slow, the beats as distant from each other as Yinti's long breaths. "Bapsia, Yinti!" Haya calls her quietly, and she has the impression that the old woman's half-closed eyes have trembled, and her pupils have moved, and that something like a smile has appeared on her lips. It's a stray smile. It undulates. Sometimes the corners of her mouth rise, sometimes they fall, and then Yinti looks dead. Her hands are tepid, not cold, and her skin is soft and pale. Haya fixes Yinti's hair, which has come out from under her kerchief, and she leans into her ear and says, "Are you still with us?" And again that smile comes from somewhere to the old woman's face, lasting just a moment before vanishing. Haya is being called from afar by the stomping of feet, so she kisses the old woman on her lukewarm cheek and runs to dance. From Yinti's chamber, you can't quite make out the melodies, which get stuck in the wooden walls, the winding corridors breaking them down into individual murmurs. All you can hear is the boom, boom of dance steps, and from time to time, a high-pitched squeal. Yinti is curious about what's going on out there. She is surprised to discover that she can easily slide out of her body and be suspended over it. She looks right at her own face, fallen and pale, a strange feeling. But soon she floats away, gliding along on the drafts of air, on the vibrations of sound, passing without difficulty through wooden walls and doors. Now Yinti sees everything from above. And then her gaze goes back to her under her closed eyelids. That's how it is the whole night, soaring and descent, back and forth over the border. It tires her. She's never worked as hard as she is working now, not when cleaning or in the garden. And yet both the falling and the rising are pleasant. The only nasty thing is that movement, whistling and rough, which tries to push her out to somewhere far away, past the horizon. That force, external and brutal, which it would be impossible to face were her body not protected by that amulet from the inside. Irreversibly. Strange. Her thoughts blow over the whole region. "Wind," says some voice in her head, which must be her own. Wind is the vision of the dead as they gaze upon the world they come from. Haven't you ever noticed the fields of grass? She wants to say to Haya how the blades bow down and are parted. That has to be because there is a dead person watching. If you counted all the dead, you'd find that there are many more of them than there are those of us living. Their souls have been cleansed already, as they have meandered through many lives, and now they await the Messiah, who will come to finish the task, and they look over everything. That's why wind blows on earth. Wind is their watchful gaze. After a moment of startled hesitation, she, too, joins in with this wind that flies over the houses of Rohatyn and the impoverished little settlements, over the carts clustered together on the market square, in the hope that some customer might happen by, over the three cemeteries, over the Catholic churches, the synagogue, the Orthodox church, over Rahartin's public house, and it dashes onward, rustling the yellowed grass on the hills. At first chaotic, in disarray, but then, as if it were learning dance steps, it speeds along the riverbeds all the way to the Dniester. There it pauses, for Yinti is astonished by the mastery of the winding line of the river, its filigrees, like the outlines of the letters Gimel and Resh. And then it continues over the border that has colluded with the river to divide two great countries. For Yinti's vision knows no such borders, after all. Yinti finds herself in the countryside, near Brezizani. It is the very day she has conceived. Only now she can see it. In this strange state in which she finds herself, is Yinti able to change things slightly? Influence the course of events? Can't she? If she could, she would change this one day. She sees a young woman walking through the fields with a basket in her hand, and in it two geese. Their necks move to the rhythm of her steps, their beady eyes looking around with the trust common to domesticated animals. A mounted Cossack patrol comes galloping out of the forest, getting bigger as she watches it approach. It is too late to run away. The woman stands astonished, covers her face with the geese. The horses surround her, closing in. As if on command, the men dismount, and now everything happens very fast and wordlessly. They push her down softly onto the grass. The basket falls. The geese get out of it, but they stay close, hissing a little quietly, threatening, warning, bearing witness to what's going on. Two of the men hold the horses while one of them unfastens the belt of his broad, wrinkled trousers and lies down on top of the woman. And then they trade. The next one faster than the first, as though he has to perform these movements in haste. There's no sign of the men's enjoying it, in fact. Their seed pours into the woman and then drips out onto the grass. The last one presses down hard on her neck, and the woman starts to resign herself to the fact that she will die. But the others hand him his reins, and the man gets back on his horse. He looks at her for a moment longer, as if wanting to remember his victim. And then they quickly ride away. It all takes just a few minutes. The woman sits with her legs akimbo, the indignant geese looking in at her, honking their disapproval. With a bit of her petticoat, she wipes between her legs, then rips up some leaves and grass. She runs to the stream and raises her skirts high and sits down in the water, pushing out all the semen from inside her. The geese think this is an encouragement to them, and they scamper up to the water's edge. But before they can quite make up their minds to get in, overcoming their usual and serene reserve, the woman stuffs both of them back into the basket and returns to the path. She slows as she comes to the village, walking slower and slower until finally she stops, as if she had reached an invisible border. This is Yinti's mother. And this must be the reason that she always watched her daughter so closely. Eventually, Yinti grew accustomed to the looks, to the suspicious gaze cast from where her mother sat at the table working on something, or stood cutting vegetables, peeling hard-boiled eggs, scrubbing pots. Her mother watched her all the time, like a wolf, like a dog getting ready to sink its teeth into her shin. With time, a slight grimace began to appear in connection with this watching, a light rise in the upper lip, pulling it up toward her nose. Not an expression of animosity or revulsion, just barely visible, insignificant. She remembers how her mother, as she was braiding Yinti's hair one day, found a dark mole above her ear and rejoiced in it. "Look," she said to Yinti's father, "she has a mole in the same spot as you, but on the other side like a reflection in the mirror." Her father listened only absent-mindedly. He never in his life suspected a thing. Yinti's mother died with the secret clenched in her fist. She died in a kind of convulsion, in a fury. She'll no doubt come back as a wild animal. Yinti was the 11th born. Her father named her Yinti, which means she who spreads the news and she who teaches others. Her mother didn't have the strength to take care of her. She was fragile of both mind and body. Yinti was dealt with by the other women who were always bustling around the house, cousins and aunt, and for some time her grandmother. She remembered her mother sliding off her cap in the evenings. And then Yinti would see from up close her mother's wretched hair, cut short and sloppily, growing over her unhealthy, flaking skin. Yinti had 6 older brothers who went to yeshiva and, at home, quoted passages from the scriptures under their breath while she hung around the table at which they sat, too young to be assigned real woman's work. She also had 4 older sisters, one of whom was already married. Significant efforts were being made to match up another. Her father, detecting her interest and zeal, showed her the letters of the alphabet, thinking they would be like little pictures for her, like jewels and stars. Lovely Aleph, like the reflection of a cat's paw. Shin, like a boat with a mast made out of bark floating on the water. But Yinti, who knew how or when, learned the letters in a different way, in such a way as to soon be able to make words of them. Her mother slapped her hands for this with an unexpected ferocity, as if Yinti were reaching for far too much. Her mother didn't know how to read. She would listen happily, however, as Yinti's father on rare occasions, or more often, their old relation Abramek, the cripple, told the women and children stories from the books in Yiddish. Abramek always did this in a plaintive voice, as if the written words were by nature akin to a lament. He would start at dusk, by the dim light of the candles, and so, along with reading, there would appear in the house in the evenings the unbearable sadness of the village Kabbalists, of whom there were many in those days. People developed a taste for this sorrow in the same way that some grow fond of vodka. They would all be overcome by such melancholy that someone would begin to cry and keen. Then they would want to touch with their hands everything of which Abramek had told, and they would reach out for something tangible. But there was nothing there. That lack was terrible. There began true despair. All around them, darkness, cold, and damp. In the summer, dust, dry grass, and stones. Where was all that? That world, that life? Where was paradise? And how could we get there? To little Yinti, it seemed that every such evening of stories grew dense, dark, impenetrable, especially when Abramek the cripple would say, "And it is known that the space of the world is filled with ghosts and evil spirits, born of human sin. These float in that space, as is written clearly in the Zohar. We have to guard against them, attaching to us on the way to the synagogue, and this is why we must know what it is written in the Zohar, namely, that the damage-doer lies in wait for you on the left side. For the mezuzah may be placed only on the right side, and on the mezuzah is written God's name, Shaddai, which will defeat the damage-doer. This explains the mezuzah's inscription, and Shaddai will be on your doorframe." They nodded in agreement. This we know. The left side. Yinti knew this. "The air is full of eyes," her mother would whisper, jerking her around like a rag doll every time she got her dressed. "They are watching you. Just put out a question before you, and the spirits will instantly answer. You just have to be able to ask. And to find those answers you receive in the milk that is spilled into the shape of the letter Samech, in the imprint of a horse's hoof in the shape of the letter Shin. Gather. Gather these signs, and soon you will read a whole sentence. What is the art of reading from books written by man, when the whole world is a book written by God, even the clay path that leads up to the river?" Look at it. The goose feathers, too. The dried rings of the wood of the fence boards. The cracks in the clay of the house's walls. This is exactly like the letter Shin. You know how to read, so read, Yente. She feared her mother and Hal, a thin, small woman who was perpetually muttering something, always with spite. Shrew, that was what everyone in the village called her. Her moods changed so frequently that Yente never knew whether her mother, setting her down on her lap, would kiss her and hug her or squeeze her shoulders painfully and shake her. So she just preferred to keep out of her way. She would watch her mother's skinny hands putting the last of her dowry back in the chest. She had come from wealthy Silesian Jews, but scarcely any of that wealth remained. Yente heard her parents moaning in bed, and she knew that this was her father chasing the Daibuk out of her mother, something he kept secret from the rest of the family. Her mother would at first try faintly to escape him, but then she would take a deep breath, like someone submerging herself in cold water, in the icy water of the mikvah, where she could hide from evil. Once, in a time of great poverty, Yente watched in secret as her mother ate the rations intended for everyone. Her back hunched, her face lanky, her eyes empty. They were so black you couldn't see her pupils in them. When Yente was 7 years old, her mother died in childbirth, along with the child who didn't have the strength to make its way out from inside her. To Yente's mind, it had obviously been a Daibuk, which her mother had eaten when she stole the provisions intended for everyone, and which her father had not managed to banish during those nocturnal struggles. That Daibuk had set up shop in her mother's stomach and had not wanted to leave. Death. That was the punishment. In the morning, when everyone is sleeping off the wedding in every corner of the house, when the sawdust in the big room is so trampled that it looks like dust, Alicia Shore enters Yente's bedroom. He is tired. His eyes are bloodshot. He sits in the bed beside her, sways back and forth, and whispers,
"It's all over now, Yente. You can go. Don't be angry I kept you this long. I had no alternative."
Gently, he pulls out from under her neckline a handful of strings and leather straps, looking for one in particular, and slides them one by one through his fingers. He assumes his tired eyes have overlooked it. He does it several times. He counts the tiny teraphim, the cases, pouches, bone tablets with spells scored into them. Everyone wears them, but old women like Yente always wear the most. There must be dozens of angels hovering around Yente, guardian spirits and other beings, nameless ones. But his amulet is not there. He finds only the string it was attached to, untied, with nothing on it. The spell has vanished, but how? Alicia Shore sobers up, his movements growing nervous. He starts to palpate the old woman. Yente lies there like a log, not moving, with that smile slowly spreading over her face. The same smile his daughter, Haya, glimpsed earlier. He lifts her inert body and searches under her back, under her hips, uncovers poor Yente's skinny extremities, her big bony feet which stick out stiffly from under her skirt. He digs in the folds of her shirt, checks her palms, and finally, more and more terrified, searches in the pillows, in the sheets, the blankets, and the quilts, under the bed and around the bed. How is this possible? It's a funny sight, this eminent, mature man rummaging around in the bedding of an ancient woman, as though he had mistaken her for a young one and were trying clumsily to clamber in with her.
"Yente, are you going to tell me what's happened?"
he says to her in a fierce whisper, as if to a child who has committed some monstrous offense. But she, of course, does not respond. Only her eyelids tremble, and her eyeballs move to one side for a moment and then to the other, and her smile quivers slightly, almost imperceptibly, but doesn't fade.
"What did you write on it?"
Haya asks her father, Sleepy, in a nightshirt, with a kerchief on her head, she has run in here at his summons. Alicia is distressed, the wrinkles on his forehead settling into soft rolling waves that draw Haya's gaze. This is how her father always looks when he feels guilty. "You know what I wrote," he says. "I held her back."
"Did you hang it around her neck?"
Her father nods.
"Father, you were supposed to put it in a box and lock it."
Her father shrugs helplessly.
"You're like a child," Haya says, at once tender and enraged. "How could you? You just put it right around her neck? Well, where is it?"
"It's nowhere. It's gone."
"Nothing disappears just like that."
Haya sets about searching, but she quickly sees there is no point. "It's gone. I've looked," he says.
"She ate it," Haya says. "She swallowed it."
Shaken, her father is silent. Then, helplessly, he says, despair rising into his voice, "Now she won't die." A strange expression of shock and suspicion appears in Haya's face. Then, slowly, it turns into one of amusement. She laughs, quietly at first, and then louder and louder until a deep roar fills the small room and explodes through the wooden walls. Her father covers her mouth with his hands. Once swallowed, the piece of paper lodges in Yinzi's esophagus near her heart. Saliva soaked, the specially prepared black ink dissolves slowly now, the letters losing their shape. Within the human body, the word splits in two, substance and essence. When the former goes, the latter, formlessly abiding, may be absorbed into the body's tissues. Since essences always seek carriers in matter, even if this is the cause of many misfortunes. Someday, Yinti will understand that bodies are like leaves in which, for a single season, for a few months, the light resides. Then they fall down dead and dry, and the darkness grinds them into dust, even as the souls within them strive impatiently for renewed incarnation. For now, lying covered up to her neck in wolfskins, Yinti simply smiles, knowing that she has deceived them all. Next, I'll read another short story from the fiction section of the November 21st, 2005 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Year of Spaghetti, by Haruki Murakami. 1971 was the year of spaghetti. In 1971, I cooked spaghetti to live and lived to cook spaghetti. Steam rising from the pot was my pride and joy. Tomato sauce bubbling up in the saucepan, my one great hope in life. I went to a cooking specialty store and bought a kitchen timer and a huge aluminum pot, big enough to bathe a German shepherd in. Then went around to all the supermarkets that catered to foreigners, gathering an assortment of odd-sounding spices. I picked up a pasta cookbook at the bookstore and bought tomatoes by the dozen. I purchased every brand of spaghetti I could lay my hands on, simmered every sauce known to man. Fine particles of garlic, onion, and olive oil swirled in the air, forming a harmonious cloud that penetrated every corner of my tiny apartment. Permeating the floor and the ceiling and the walls, my clothes, my books, my records, my tennis racket, my bundles of old letters, it was a fragrance one might have smelled on ancient Roman aqueducts. This is a story from the year of spaghetti, 1971 A.D. As a rule, I cooked spaghetti and ate it by myself. I was convinced that spaghetti was a dish best enjoyed alone. I can't really explain why I felt that way, but there it is. I always drank tea with my spaghetti and ate a simple lettuce and cucumber salad. I'd make sure I had plenty of both. I laid everything out neatly on the table and enjoyed a leisurely meal, glancing at the paper as I ate. From Sunday to Saturday, one spaghetti day followed another, and each new Sunday started a brand new spaghetti week. Every time I sat down to a plate of spaghetti, especially on a rainy afternoon, I had the distinct feeling that somebody was about to knock on my door. The person who I imagined was about to visit me was different each time. Sometimes it was a stranger. Sometimes someone I knew. Once it was a girl with slim legs whom I dated in high school. And once it was myself from a few years back, come to pay a visit. Another time it was William Holden with Jennifer Jones on his arm. William Holden? Not one of those people, however, actually ventured into my apartment. They hovered just outside the door without knocking, like fragments of memory, and then slipped away. Spring, summer, and fall, I cooked and cooked, as if cooking spaghetti were an act of revenge. Like a lonely, jilted girl throwing old love letters into the fireplace, I tossed one handful of spaghetti after another into the pot. I'd gather up the trampled-down shadows of time, knead them into the shape of a German shepherd, toss them into the rolling water, and sprinkle them with salt. Then I'd hover over the pot, oversized chopsticks in hand, until the timer dinged its plaintive note. Spaghetti strands are a crafty bunch, and I couldn't let them out of my sight. If I were to turn my back, they might well slip over the edge of the pot and vanish into the night. The night lay in silent ambush, hoping to waylay the prodigal strands. Spaghetti alla parmigiana, spaghetti alla napoletana, spaghetti alla cartuccio, spaghetti aglio olio, spaghetti alla carbonara, spaghetti della pina. And then there was the pitiful, nameless leftover spaghetti, carelessly tossed into the fridge. Born in the heat, the strands of spaghetti washed down the river of 1971 and vanished. I mourn them all. All the spaghetti of the year 1971. When the phone rang at 3:20 p.m., I was sprawled out on the tatami, staring at the ceiling. A pool of winter sunlight had formed in the place where I lay. Like a dead fly, I lay there, vacant in a December spotlight. At first, I didn't recognize the sound as the phone ringing. It was more like an unfamiliar memory that had hesitantly slipped in between the layers of air. Finally, though, it began to take shape, and in the end, a ringing phone was unmistakably what it was. It was 100% a phone ring and 100% real air. Still sprawled out, I reached over and picked up the receiver. On the other end was a girl. A girl so indistinct that by 4:30, she might very well have disappeared altogether. She was the ex-girlfriend of a friend of mine. Something had brought them together, this guy and this indistinct girl, and something had led them to break up. I admit, reluctantly played a role in getting them together in the first place. "Sorry to bother you," she said, "but do you know where he is now?" I looked at the phone, running my eyes along the length of the cord. The cord was, sure enough, attached to the phone. I managed a vague reply. There was something ominous in the girl's voice, and whatever trouble was brewing, I knew that I didn't want to get involved. "Nobody will tell me where he is," she said in a chilly tone. "Everybody's pretending they don't know. But there's something important I have to tell him, so please... tell me where he is. I promise. I won't drag you into this. Where is he?"
"I honestly don't know," I told her. "I haven't seen him in a long time." My voice didn't sound like my own. I was telling the truth about not having seen him for a long time, but not about the other part. I did know his address and phone number. Whenever I tell a lie, something weird happens to my voice. No comment from her. The phone was like a pillar of ice. Then all the objects around me turned into pillars of ice, as if I were in a J.G. Ballard science fiction story. "I really don't know," I repeated. "He went away a long time ago without saying a word."
"Give me a break," the girl laughed. "He's not that clever. We're talking about a guy who has to make a lot of noise no matter what he does."
Well, she was right. The guy was really a bit of a dim bulb. But I wasn't about to tell her where he was. Do that, and next I'd have him on the phone giving me an earful. I was through with getting caught up in other people's messes. I'd already dug a hole in the backyard and buried everything that needed to be buried in it. Nobody could ever dig it up again. I'm sorry, I said. You don't like me, do you? She said suddenly. Now, I had no idea what to say. I didn't particularly dislike her. I had no real impression of her at all. It's hard to have a bad impression of somebody you have no impression of. I'm sorry, I said again, but I'm cooking spaghetti right now. I'm sorry? I said I'm cooking spaghetti. I lied. I had no idea why I said that, but the lie had already become a part of me, so much so that at the moment, at least, it didn't feel like a lie at all. I went ahead and filled an imaginary pot with imaginary water, lit an imaginary stove with an imaginary match. So? She asked. I sprinkled imaginary salt into the boiling water, gently lowered a handful of imaginary spaghetti into the imaginary pot, set the imaginary kitchen timer for 8 minutes. So, I can't talk. The spaghetti will be ruined. She didn't say anything. Look, I'm really sorry, but cooking spaghetti is a delicate operation. The girl was silent. The phone in my hand began to freeze again. So, could you call me back? I added hurriedly. Because you're in the middle of making spaghetti? She asked. Yeah. Are you making it for someone? Are you going to eat it alone? Oh, I'll eat it by myself, I said. She held her breath for a long time and then slowly breathed out. There's no way that you could know this, but I'm really in trouble. I don't know what to do. Well, you know, I'm sorry, I can't help you, I said. There's some money involved, too. I see. He owes me money, she said. I lent him some money. I shouldn't have, but I had to. I was quiet for a minute, my thoughts drifting towards spaghetti. I'm sorry, I said, but I've got the spaghetti going, so... She gives a listless laugh. Yeah, goodbye, she said. Say hi to your spaghetti for me. I hope it turns out okay. Bye, I said. When I hung up the phone, the circle of light on the floor had shifted an inch or two. I lay down again in that pool of light and resumed staring at the ceiling. Thinking about spaghetti that boils eternally but is never done is a sad, sad thing. Now, I regret a little that I didn't tell the girl anything. Perhaps I should have. I mean, her ex-boyfriend wasn't much to start with, an empty shell of a guy with artistic pretensions, a great talker whom nobody trusted. She sounded as if she were really strapped for money, and... No matter what the situation, you've got to pay back what you borrow. Sometimes I wonder what happened to the girl. The thought usually pops into my mind when I'm facing a steaming hot plate of spaghetti. After she hung up the phone, did she disappear forever, sucked into the 4:30 p.m. shadows? Was I partly to blame? I want you to understand my position, though. At the time, I didn't want to get involved with anyone. That's why I kept on cooking spaghetti all by myself, in that huge pot, big enough to hold a German Shepherd. Durum, semolina, golden wheat wafting in Italian fields. Can you imagine how astonished the Italians would be if they knew that what they were exporting in 1971 was really loneliness? And now, from the September 20, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the Talk of the Town section, Oregon Postcard. A Wildfire Investigator Searches for a Spark by Oliver Wang. Sitting in his Ford pickup last month in the sagebrush-covered hills of eastern Oregon, Al Crouch heard his two-way radio beep 11 times. Please stand by for a smoke report. A voice crackled. We got our first of the day, Crouch said, pulling out.
The dispatcher had indicated that the report came from I-84 near mile marker 322. Crouch, who is tall with a bushy mustache, is a wildland fire investigator for the Vail District Bureau of Land Management, which covers roughly 5 million acres. He spent more than two decades fighting fire on the ground, trying to get in front of the flames. Now, he moves in the opposite direction, toward a fire source, which can be a range of things. In his office is a box full of examples. Flares, fireworks, bullets, trailer chains rubbed shiny on the road, tattered retread tires, heat-warped wheel bearings, sky lanterns, a letter ripped into pieces and set on fire, you all night, I love, dot, 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 and positive, babe, dot, 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 that we will one day. Then there are the things that can't fit in a box. Sparking, electrical wires, a tiki torch, weed whackers, spontaneously combusting bales of hay, birds fried by power lines. At mile marker 332, Crouch started wondering if the report was a false alarm. He was nearing a cement plant and quarry where, in the past, a passerby had called in fires after residual dust drifted over the interstate. Crouch looked at the sky. 70% of wildfires in the Vail District, whose largest county has more cattle than humans, he said, are started by lightning, and a barometric ridge was moving up from Nevada, bringing storms with it. Crouch's method is to get to the fire as quickly as possible, to interview witnesses, and to start searching for evidence. He also brainstorms possible causes. In this corridor, I have power lines, gas lines, and there are some rail lines, he said, as he pulled alongside a train churning through the valley. He rolled down the window, and a metallic sound filled the truck. If you go around a corner, the wheel will slide against the side of the track and grind, and that could cause a fire. But before determining a fire's cause, he needs to find out where it started. At the scene of a burn, he's often greeted by a sea of black, which can sometimes span 100,000 acres. The ignition point could be the size of a fingernail. To find it, he works backwards. Burn patterns in grass, remnants of shrubs and trees, stains on rocks, heat marks on fences. Moving delicately around the crime scene, he plants small colored flags. Red indicates the advancing flame. Yellow, flanking fire. Blue, fire that moves against the wind. White, the origin. In structural fires, the origin is often the hottest point, and much of the evidence is obliterated. Wildfires are different. A cigarette can survive the wildfire it started. Crouch has one in his office collection. A book of matches can also survive. Crouch has one of those, too, proof of arson. On I-84, Crouch passed a blown tire on the shoulder. His truck's thermometer read 98 degrees. It hadn't rained in weeks. A few miles south, a blown tire had started the previous fire he investigated. It burned about 500 acres of hillside. He found the cause, but he didn't find a suspect. Fire cause and fire intensity are two different things. It can be super dry to the point where you could fart and you'd start a fire, but if there's no spark, there's no fire, he said. This year, with a light winter snowpack, record heat, and a drought, the rangeland is set to blow. But although the valley to the north was covered in a haze from forest fires out west, he hadn't seen that many fires. It's all cyclical, he said, except for acres burned. Every year, that average goes up. At mile marker 322, smoke rose from behind a guardrail. Behind it was privately owned land. Four different firefighting groups showed up, and by the time Crouch arrived, the Baker Rural Fire Department had put out the flames, leaving a strip of dark ash along the highway. The wind was blowing to the northwest. Crouch walked up to the Baker Rural Fire Chief, Sean Lee, who held a thick red hose next to the highway. They looked down the slope at a car that lay crushed and carbonized at the heel of the fire. Two firefighters walked around it warily. The driver stood by the side of the road, nearly unharmed. He had refused medical attention.
into his radio. Kraut said, "Looks to be about an acre long and skinny along the guardrail." He looked at the car again. "Sometimes it's obvious," he said, smiling. And now a poem, also from the September 13th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Tin, T-I-N, by Jane Hirschfield. "I studied much and remembered little, but the world is generous. It kept offering figs and cheeses. Never mind that soon I'll have to give it all back, the world, the figs. To be a train station of existence is no small matter. It doesn't need to be Grand Central or Haidarpasa station. The engine shed could be low, windowed with coal dust under a slat-shingled roof. It could be tin. Another mystery bandage with rivets and rubies, leaking cold and heat in both directions, as the earth does." Well, we have time for a cartoon or two. In the first cartoon, a man has fallen asleep on the couch. His book is on his chest. And a dog is sitting on his legs and a cat up on the back of the couch. And the dog says, "He started calling me his best friend years ago, and now it's way too awkward to tell him I don't feel the same way." In the final cartoon, a bull is sitting at a restaurant table, peering at the menu. The waiter is holding out a bottle of wine, and the waiter says, "I think you'll find this wine to be quite infuriating." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.